Welcome, listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. With all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforawakening.com. That's timeforawakening.com, which is the website, and listen to the program and live stream there. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforawakening and enjoy the live stream there. Or you can download the TuneIn app to any of your devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn app, in the search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live on any of your devices, even into your car. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. That's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. You can go to that Facebook search engine and type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media has been launched. It should be one of your favorites. You can put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. That's timeforanawakening.com. It'll take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. There you'll see more interesting contents, blogs, articles, and podcasts of the programs that you can download, listen at later times, or even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have a special guest join us, author, Professor of History and African American Studies at Duke University, Professor Adrian Lent Smith, will be with us. Tonight, we'll be talking about subjects centering around her book, Freedom Struggles, African Americans in World War I. It's an interesting period for our people, our ancestors in this country, and we'll be talking about it with our guests after we come back from a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215 215- 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our special guest in the program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, activist here in Philadelphia, and tour guide at the African American Museum here in the city of Philadelphia at 7th and Arch. Brother Richard is with me on the line. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir. How you doing, Brother Ellen?
How are you, sir?
Good, good, good. Once again, I see that we're about to engage into a very fruitful and meaningful conversation, dialogue around World War One period in African American experience with Dr. Lutz Smith. And I'm glad that she's engaging us on this Mother's Day, a woman, a mother of us in relationship to providing the historical experience. It becomes really helpful in continuing our nurturing process.
I agree, Brother Richard. You know, this was an interesting period of our people here in this country. We've always fought in wars since we've been here on these shores. Some of the early wars of some of the other historians that have been on, we've seen that our people have fought on both sides. The Civil War, once we got involved, we kind of changed the tide of the war and saved the Union. But it was an interesting period during the World War One for our people. It was a lot of dynamics going on other than the war. It'll be an interesting subject with our guest this evening, Professor of History of African American Studies at Duke University and also an author of the book Freedom Struggles, African Americans and World War One. I want to welcome to our program Professor Adrian Lynn Smith. Professor Lynn Smith, are you there?
I am here. Glad to be here.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you doing?
Great. I'm glad to have you on the program with myself and Brother Richard.
And I have to say, happy Mother's Day to you, and we definitely appreciate the work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you very, very much.
I know this might have been a busy day for you. But I'm glad that you kind of allotted some time for us this evening.
Well, you know, Duke always schedules their graduation for Mother's Day. So I saw a bunch of proud mothers seeing their children graduate. Then I came home and played with my children, and now I'm here. So many mothers, many ways of doing it.
Okay. Professor Lynn Smith, interesting subject, World War One, and in your book, Freedom Struggles, African Americans, and the World War One Struggle for Freedom. Before we get into the dynamic around what was going on with some of our ancestors during that period, talk about yourself and why you wrote this book.
Well, so I am a historian. I studied history as a college undergraduate. And I, when I was in college, wrote a paper for a class on African-American history that required me to read The Crisis, the NAACP's monthly magazine from the 19-teens. And I came across this report of a soldiers' mutiny / what they called a race riot in Houston in 1917 in Houston, Texas. And I opened it up and I said, there were black soldiers in World War One? And then I said, and they shot people? And so from that came this paper for this undergraduate class. And from the paper came a thesis. I discovered that W.E.B. Du Bois had always intended to write a history of African-American soldiers in World War One, and never finished it, but had gathered all of this material, so his papers had that. And so I used some of the material he gathered, wrote an honors thesis, then went to graduate school and wrote a dissertation on the same topic, and that dissertation became my book. And I was interested in a few things, in their experience overall, just understanding what happened, in thinking about the ways that manhood and citizenship and soldiering were all wrapped up in conversations about what black people in America deserve. And then also I was interested in the war as a moment when people who'd never thought about a world bigger than the one that sort of hemmed them in stepped into the world and discovered other forms of connection or kinship or solidarity and what that meant then for subsequent struggle.
Professor Lynn Smith, you brought up W.E.B. Du Bois, and it was interesting that during that period of the war and leading up to it, that several people during that period that were kind of icons, historical icons for our people at that time, Du Bois himself, A. Philip Randolph, William Monroe Trotter, and Marcus Garvey. William Monroe Trotter and Marcus Garvey and A. Philip Randolph spoke out against blacks enlisting in the Selective Service and fighting in the World War. Du Bois was in favor of it. He said that it was a chance for our people to prove their manhood, so to speak. I'm paraphrasing. And he encouraged blacks to enlist in the war. And almost, according to published reports, over 400,000 of our ancestors did enlist in the war. Talk about it from your perspective and looking at it historically.
Some of them enlisted. A lot of them were drafted.
Okay.
Because the people who wanted to enlist, by and large, weren't allowed to.
Okay.
Right? So they ended up being drafted. There were some folks, a smaller number of folks, who enlisted, but most of that, almost 400,000, were people who were conscripted labor. But no, you're right. Du Bois, he was one of the few people. That's not true. He was of the folks that you mentioned: Trotter, A. Philip Randolph, Garvey, the sort of black male leaders that we think about as being the icons of that moment. He was the most unequivocal pro-participation voice. And even then, he had some ambivalence, but what he said, you know, he wrote a editorial that basically said, if we fight, we'll learn the fighting game and cease to be so easily lynched, right? That there's something that we can get out of this, both in terms of military training, in terms of increased militancy, but then also in terms of, you know, in this moment when he still believed this was possible, showing to the rest of America that black people deserved their rights and thinking that from deserving would come some kind of just compensation, right? The experience of the war, the subsequent post-war, would disabuse him of that. And he was excoriated by folks like Randolph and Trotter for taking this position in the first place. And my colleague Chad Williams, who is the chair of Afro-American history at Brandeis, Chad is writing about Du Bois right now, and Du Bois in World War One. And what he says is that a lot of his writing that you see in the 1920s is about him trying to come to terms with, articulate some sort of makeup for the mistake he made in pushing for African Americans to willingly participate.
Professor Lynn Smith, during that period of time, as you stated, a lot of our people had to sign up for selective service, and they, I think that they had envisioned fighting in the war, but a lot of our people that were, it was a very few of us, percentage-wise, that did actual fighting in World War One. A lot of our people were in labor battalions and building roads, digging trenches, things of that nature. There were some fighting by some of our ancestors, but talk about it from the black soldiers' perspective. What did it mean during that period for black Americans to fight in World War One on the side of the United States?
So symbolically, it meant a lot to them, right? And one of the reasons that people wanted to fight, and you're right, so there are 386,000-ish folks who served in the wartime military. Of those, 200,000 went overseas and fought in and served in Europe. Of that 200,000, only 40,000 were combat troops. So you have roughly 10% of the black folks in the army who actually see combat. Everybody else is working as labor. But whether they worked as laborers or whether they worked as combat troops, the symbolic relationship between soldiering, military service, mm-hmm. and citizenship rights was so strong,
okay.
that white supremacists in the army, or not even in the army, white supremacists overall did not want them in the army. It's James K. Vardaman, who's a horrible, horrible Mississippi senator, who says, who's anti-conscription, who says, if you give a Negro a gun, it's, and tell him to fight for democracy, or, you know, fight for the country, it's one short step to him thinking that he should use that gun at home, basically, right? And I remember reading that and thinking, well, you know, Senator, you're right. And there was a way in which the worst white supremacists understood black aspiration more than white moderates who tried to downplay that aspiration.
Before we, because I think a lot more happened for our people after the war was over and when soldiers started coming home than their experiences in the war. In brief, talk about our ancestors' experience in the war. And I think we'll spend a lot of time talking about their experiences when they came home. But talk about their experience in the war.
So you have these folks, some of whom, I mean, many of whom are serving as laborers, right, and doing, as you said, the worst, building roads, loading and unloading tons and tons of cargo, being in charge in some instances of digging up the dead and reburying them, right, into graves, heartbreaking and gut-wrenching work. So you have that going on. You have with the soldiers, so of the soldiers who served, some of them were handed over to the French army for the duration of the war and see terrible, crushing fighting on the Western Front. So you have the trauma of war, right? The thing that traumatized a generation of soldiers, white, black, Latino, Native American, what have you. And then on top of all of that, you have all of these white folks in the army with black soldiers who are worried that serving abroad will give people ideas. And so they're working to maintain the sort of white supremacist racial order, even in France, where American, where the dynamics of race relations are slightly different. So soldiers writing home keep saying, you know, I have a friend who was shot for talking to a white woman, or arrested for crossing the street to flirt with a white woman, or, you know, we went into a bar and ended up in a fight because white American soldiers were trying to make sure that we weren't allowed in the bar. And the French, by contrast, who, not that they were without racism, right? They had their own empire to manage, their own concerns, but they didn't see African Americans as part of their racial problem. They treated them as Americans first, and weren't really invested in helping the Americans maintain their own racial code. And so for black folks who'd only ever known Jim Crow, or for folks, even if they didn't know Jim Crow in the U.S., but were discovering it in the U.S. Army, you know, when they came from some northern cities, that encounter with what they thought of as sort of French true republicanism was revelatory. Right? So on the one hand, they have the revelation of France combined with the deep, deep, deep bitterness and disillusion of realizing that their fellow American soldiers are, in many instances, more invested in policing them than in effectively, than using them to effectively fight the war. And so those things really feed a sort of new political consciousness and an intensified radicalism for a number of returning soldiers.
You know, during that period of time, when if you look, it was a lot of things going on, not only on the war front, but at home. You had, during that time, an openly racist president, Woodrow Wilson, that invited D.W. Griffith to the White House for a screening of Birth of a Nation, made glowing accolades and on his review of the film. And also you had, and I want to read that because you just alluded to it about 5 minutes ago, the statements by then Senator James Vardaman. But I want to read for the listening audience what he stated on the floor of Congress that kind of gives a flavor of what was going on in government during that period. It mentioned and I'm going to read this from a published report. In Congress, the fear that returning soldiers posed a threat to racial hierarchy in the South was a matter of public record. On August 16, 1917, Senator James K. Vardaman of Mississippi, speaking on the Senate floor, warned that the reintroduction of black servicemen to the South would inevitably lead to disaster. For Senator Vardaman, and for others like him, black soldiers' patriotism was a threat, not a virtue. Impress the Negro with the fact that he is defending the flag, infatuate his untutored soul with military airs, teach him that his duty to keep the emblem of the United of the Nations flying triumphantly in the air, and the senator cautioned, but it is a short step to the conclusion that his political rights must be respected. So you had, I mean, the political environment was totally against our people, which is no surprise. But it's really strange to look at our people fighting for a country that always was ready to put obstacles in their way. And in this period of time, they did it openly. We seem to have a resurgence of that. But when you had the president making racist statements, some of the key senators pushing for bills on the Senate floor. This really led for an environment to, when our returning servicemen came home, that it was a cauldron or a mix that was going to be deadly when they arrived back on these shores. Before I get you to respond to that, Professor Lentz, I want Brother Richard to jump in here because we had been discussing this before you came on, and I know that he might have some things other than the area that I'm venturing into. But go ahead, Brother Richard.
Yes, and once again, thank you, Professor Dr. Lynn Smith, for doing the work. I'm kind of interested from two vantage points right now. I understand that now that it's 2017, that we're having a centennial around World War One. So the question of, in one case, celebrating America's involvement in World War One, we're basically engaged in for a year. And I was able to see part of your, part of the PBS series that you were a part of. But I'm following up on this question of the context of the social and political moment that those men and women were involved in at that time. You raised this issue about manhood. How did you see this quest or development or need for African Americans to exhibit their manhood in that time before the Selective Service Act came into being, and what would have, and then you kind of alluded to, but what was the thinking as the Selective Service Act came into being, and they had no choice to engage in the military?
Well, so, you know, manhood in this period, well, for one, when people denied African Americans the status, when they refused to talk about African Americans as men, right, as they did sort of segregationist white folks, it was because sometimes they were comparing them to children, right? Woodrow Wilson, in a writing about Reconstruction when he was still a history professor, described newly emancipated enslaved folks as dusky children untimely let out of school, right? So that's one sort of denial of adulthood. Sometimes they compared them to beasts, right? So the opposite of manhood then, sort of the opposite of manhood as in humanity being something bestial. So you have these kind of narratives in play. But most Americans agreed, whatever they thought Africans were not, African Americans were not, they agreed that soldiers were men, right? And that soldiers and men deserved citizenship rights. Like, it was sort of symbolically one of the most deserving, and in some ways it still is. Think about these kind of, the tension still around, or the way that you can immobilize America's abandonment of veterans to sort of pursue social services. If anyone deserved anything, soldiers deserved something. And Americans felt that so acutely that in the wake of the Spanish-American War, Southern legislatures disbanded black militias because they couldn't figure out how they could disfranchise African Americans and let them, you know, have militias at the same time. And then you have the kind of, like, the politics of respectability folks for whom manhood and appropriate manhood is a shorthand for good and worthy conduct and character. And they think that that will be on display to counter the kind of white supremacist propaganda that is circulating in this period. But the war changes. Mobilizing for the war, conscription, as you mentioned, and then serving in the war changes what people imagine manhood to be and what manhood is. And the first tension comes with conscription, where some folks feel like being denied the privilege of enlisting or having their labor, like, demanded of them, kind of lessens their authority and their independence. But for the folks who end up abroad, however they end up there, and who suffer abroad in whatever way, through labor or through combat, they know who they are, and they know what they've earned, and for many of them, they come back ready to invoke that manhood as they look towards self-defense, right? So the sort of the term and the idea of it is being mobilized in a number of different ways. But it has a currency that can be used for many of the groups who are contesting the vision of what should come, contesting over what should come next.
And I kind of look at, and Elliot had mentioned earlier, Woodrow Wilson, and I'm kind of looking at this quote of where Wilson, when he was viewing, getting ready to view Birth of a Nation, and that was 2 years prior, how he was saying that the white men were roused by the mere instinct of self-preservation until at last there had sprung into existence a great Ku Klux Klan of a vulnerable empire of the South to protect the Southern country. And here these men 2 years later are, you know, kind of I'm reading into what you said in relationship to Du Bois' concern, because it seemed that the that empire, the Klan empire, it was just not a subjective thing of African-American manhood, but really the question of how we were going to deal with this white supremacist empire that was oppressing us, and men being men, whether we were engaged or not, but now getting that training. How was the social conditioning for, or were you able to see the social impact of the Klan impact on African Americans who joined or were subscribed to the service? How was that a part of that choice also?
Well, so it depended on where you were in the South, because there were many folks in the South. So, you know, the Klan is reborn in 1915. Wilson is talking in Birth of a Nation about the early Klan, but the Birth of a Nation spurs a second Klan to arise in 1915. So they are gaining in popularity and in adherence at the same moment that the U.S. is mobilizing for war. But in largely agrarian South, where Southerners, white and black, are really ambivalent about going to war, and some of them don't actually believe in conscription for, you know, they don't want the government conscripting them into the army either, the white folks. So you see, depending on what town you're in, there are some draft boards that will draft more African Americans because they don't want their white children going. And then there's some draft boards that'll draft more white youth because they don't believe that African Americans deserve the honor of being soldiers. So it plays out differently in different localities. But what you get across the board, both with the Klan or with other sort of self-appointed vigilante terrorist groups, right, is that however people end up in the army and whoever ends up in the army, there are vigilantes trying to ensure that mobilization will not come with rising aspirations, right? Even as we see mobilization gear up as America goes into the war, you also see a spike in the number of lynchings, which had, for the first part of the 20th century, you know, from a peak in the early part of the 20th century, had been, I mean, still a lot, but slowly decreasing. With wartime mobilization, the number of lynchings spikes back up again. And it's always important to note, I think, as y'all probably know, that when we talk about these lynchings in the 19-teens, we're not talking about sort of secretive private affairs. We're talking about big public advertised ahead of crowds gathering sort of events, right? Spectacles, as they're called. So, you know, there's this infamous, horrid lynching in Memphis, Tennessee, which I think is emblematic of both the wartime fervor and the intensity of white supremacist violence, where a man is burned alive in Memphis while, you know, hundreds, maybe even more, of folks are gathered on a lawn before him. They sing psalms songs. They sing, "Nearer My God to Thee," sell lemonade, place a flag on the place where he was burned afterward, right? And so their sense of patriotism, religiosity, and anti-black terror are really folded and sort of bound up in one another in this wartime moment.
you know, what we're going to do, we're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, I want to move into the period of, because as I mentioned, there was some other things going on in the country related to the war that wasn't exactly dealing with the war, that kind of spilled over, so to speak. I'll explain what I'm talking about when we come back from break. But you can get involved, too, in this conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832 to join the conversation with author, professor of history and African-American studies at Duke University, Professor Adrian Lentz Smith. The book, Freedom Struggles, African-Americans and World War I. We'll be right back.
Are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
What is in 1 million brothers and sisters who are tired of the same old rhetoric, the same old leaders, the same old ways of dealing with political and economic empowerment? If you realize that nobody's going to save black people but us, if you understand that no existing political party prioritizes the best interests of African Americans as a collective, if you believe that leadership is as leadership does, and this means that the best leaders for the black collective must come from the ranks of those who place and hold the best interests of black people foremost and uttermost, if you understand that black people must develop the mindset and the will to finance their own racial uplift organizational efforts, then get involved with 1 million conscious black voters and contributors. The movement is now. Go to www.iamoneofthemillion.com. That's www.iamoneofthemillion.com.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
No, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either.
Nah, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you would on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm gonna go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our stories.
Let's buy Black365.com.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. We're joined in conversation this evening with also Professor of History and African American Studies at Duke University, Professor Adrienne Lynn Smith. The topics centering around her book, Freedom Struggles, African Americans and World War I. You can join this conversation too by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Professor Lynn Smith, you know, during that period of World War One, according to a lot of writings, the European immigration to the United States was either halted or severely curtailed, which led to Northern factories needing workers severely. Some Northern factory owners, white Northern factory owners, openly recruited blacks to come from the South to get jobs in Northern factories, which led to what we know now as the Great Migration. Blacks leaving the South, headed to Northern cities, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, Detroit, Cleveland, others, looking for and finding work. This, in the minds of certain whites, led to a competition for jobs, even though Jim Crow laws and just laws in this country, period, always bent in the favor of white folks getting work and keeping work. But talk about how this played in to the cauldron boiling over when blacks started coming back from the war.
Well, you're exactly right. So this is the period that kicks off the Great Migration, one of the, you know, most dramatic demographic shifts in the U.S., modern U.S. history. And it causes tensions in cities. It causes tensions as people try to find a place to live. And discriminatory rental practices push them into some parts of cities and not into others. Pressures, you know, folks in different parts try to maintain neighborhoods in places like Chicago as Irish or Polish or what have you, sort of enforcing segregation by ethnicity. And at the same time, you have what people perceive as competition for jobs, in large part because African Americans aren't given aren't allowed into labor unions, right? Mm-hmm. So when workers are going on strike, white workers are going on strike because of intensely unfair wartime labor conditions, or trying to move to get better wages because of the exigencies of wartime mobilization, employers turn to black, not unionized black labor, which white laborers call scab labor, or scabs, even though African-American laborers don't really have a lot of choice because they don't have other options. And you see tensions spill over into violence. In 1917 in East St. Louis, for example, you get what was, up until that moment, one of the worst riots in American history, one that commentators say is better referred to as a pogrom, sort of large-scale attack on decimation of African-American and African-American neighborhoods. And that sets the stage for similar kinds of acts of terroristic, white terroristic mob violence against African-American communities, you know, recent migrants and sort of older settlers, and then after the war's end, against returning soldiers who see this violence unfolding and resolve to help defend their homes and the homes of their friends and family.
Professor Lynn Smith, you devoted a chapter in your book, or a great portion of a chapter, to Edgar Caldwell. The incident that happened with him, because it's just two incidents. One you talked about earlier in the program when it first started, the Houston uprising in 1917. But talk about the incident that happened with Sergeant Caldwell and the legal lynching that happened. I mean, to read that story, it was almost some of these stories you're familiar with, but when you read the details of them, it almost tears your heart out. You just can't believe that this type of stuff went on and was sanctioned by government. It wasn't like they took Sergeant Caldwell behind a barn and did this with no witnesses. I mean, this stuff was right out front. Hierarchy in the army knew about this. It had been taken to some of the high courts to stop it. I mean, this was openly done. Talk about Sergeant Caldwell for our listening audience.
I will. So, and you're right, this is a gut-wrenching story in part because it's a failure of a system that people had given their lives over to, right? They really invested in and believed in. But Edgar Caldwell was a soldier stationed in Anniston, Alabama at Camp McClellan. African-American, had actually previously been a member before the war, earlier in his life, in the regular army, one of the four black regular army regiments that existed. He'd gotten out, had come back in, and was serving in stateside in a unit doing largely labor during the war. And he was taking a streetcar from Hobson City, just outside of Anniston, back to camp when he got into an argument with the conductor of the streetcar. The conductor started beating him up, kicked him off the streetcar, continued to beat on him, and Caldwell defended himself, ended up shooting the streetcar conductor, as he would say, adamantly later, and so, well, as others would say about him, he actually claimed innocence altogether, but others would say shot him in self-defense.
I think according to published reports that that someone else got into motorman or something got involved, and they both would kind of double-team, jumped him.
So he's being beaten by two men.
Okay.
Right. And could have been, and had good reason to think that he wouldn't have just been beaten within an inch of his life, but could have been beaten to death, mm-hmm. because this was the kind of thing that happened. as Robin Kelly, historian, has said, writing about World War II, but it's true, you know, for throughout the early part of the 20th century, streetcars, he says, serve as theaters of conflict, right? That you often see these kind of violent encounters, enforcement through violence of Southern racial codes on streetcars. But Caldwell shoots both the conductor and the motorman. At least one of them dies. I can't remember if both of them do. He's tried for murder. He is convicted, and there's a sort of rush to execute him when local black folks in Anniston step in. Local NAACP starts pushing the national office to do something about this, right? And this is a common thing, too, that you see local and NAACP, the NAACP branches proliferated, grew enormously during the World War One, and local branches were often much more ready to take on controversial things than the national office would have done without pressure from folks. So you see this kind of bottom-up mobilization, attempt to mobilize NAACP resources. But they get the NAACP into it, and my phone is beeping for reason, I don't know. And then they bring in lawyers, and they try to convince the Supreme Court to issue a habeas writ to move him out of the state court system into the federal court system, arguing that since he was a soldier in uniform at the time of his arrest, he should then be tried within the federal government. But the Supreme Court turns their back on Caldwell, and he is ultimately executed.
Brother Richard.
Yeah, as you bring that up, it's kind of once again these dualities of the period and then now, but it raises the question about the citizens part of your that you were developing and developed in your book, and what when you raise about the participation in the NAACP. It seems that another participation was going on as far as the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And is all of this African Americans' response to World War One as far as in the migration to exert their personhood in this? And hopefully I'm not characterizing it incorrectly, but in this hostile environment. You know, I would take it as this is the second generation after the Civil War, and still the stereotypes, the Klan, and all these things are pushing African Americans to still recognize that it's a body, it's here. So, are these mobilizations into these organizations acts of now and dealing with the question of their citizenship, the expression of their citizenship, as you see it, utilizing the not just the veterans in the service, but the migration to wartime manufacturing work.
Yeah, absolutely. And expressions of their citizenship. And then in a lot of instances, and especially if you think about the UNIA or other organizations like it, ways to imagine assertion of worth or a claim of rights or deserving things that aren't locked into the language of citizenship, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes the claim is to the U.S. government, the sort of NAACP move with Caldwell is to say, you would be a better steward of his well-being than the states would. He is a citizen, recognize that. But there are a lot of folks who, by war's end, or even over the course of the war, are like, we're done with citizenship, right? We're done with making that the place where we stake our claim. Maybe this is just about getting somewhere else, moving from Mississippi to Chicago, and figuring out how to build our worth through work. Or maybe this is about exile, right? So you have the soldiers who don't come back after wars end because having discovered that they have a freedom in Europe that they don't have at home, they want to live within that freedom for a while. However, you know, partial that still is. And then you have the folks who flock to the UNIA, and among them many soldiers who say this is an articulation of solidarity, of community, of politics, of economics that allows us to imagine a completely different, like a different map, a different political map, a different set of affiliations, a different way of talking about who we are and why we matter. But I think you're right that there's something about the intensity of this Jim Crow moment, right? And the grimness of it, right? That first generation out of slavery thought they were building something. The second generation is seeing the intensity and the efficacy of the reaction against what they built, and they're looking for any number of different ways to continue the struggle, right? So it's actually a very creative and generative moment, even in the midst of what Rayford Logan once called the nadir.
And when you say creative, it brings to mind, you know, I want to be a knowledgeable jazz lover, right? But I'm an undercover jazz lover, right? I just know I love the music. And out of those soldiers also comes, and out of that, as you call it, that creative expressions from the war, comes this these bands or band leaders that propagate this cultural imaginative art form. How is that developed in World War One? How does James York Reese and other band leaders provide the expression or add to the cultural nuance as you see it being soldiers? What creates that freedom to create these art forms in that respect?
With James Reese Europe, who was the head of the 15th New York National Guard unit, black unit that formed sort of right before the U.S. entered the war out of Harlem. So James Reese Europe, he's a band leader before he started, wanted to join the 15th New York. They convince him, the folks who were putting the unit together, convince him to take his skills as a band leader and to make a hell of a band, basically. And he said, okay, but if we're going to do this, we're going to do this the way that I sort of envision doing it. And so he pulled together great musicians, went down to Puerto Rico, got some Afro-Puerto Ricans, and made this amazing band with syncopated beats. You know, they played the music that they found exciting, which was jazz music. And so it's not that jazz came into being in the war moment, but it got an international audience in the war moment, right? They go abroad. They're one of the units that is brigaded with the French army. They travel across France playing jazz. Which becomes, ironically, again, for folks who so many Americans are trying to marginalize in the American Army, their music, this band music, becomes emblematic. It becomes the American cultural product that French audiences are, like, wild to consume. So it's, again, part of this reception of African American in Europe as Americans in ways that they never would have been, were not accepted or embraced at home.
One thing, if I may, Elliot, one thing I wanted to ask you, Dr. Lynn Smith, is that, I'm a Garveyite myself, and I'm always interested in trying to understand our experience in that. So the question I have in that regard is, those soldiers who do go to France and go to Europe, do they become more, do a segment, and were you able to see a segment that becomes politicized to the Africans, therefore kind of creating a understanding of, or the development to that Pan-African thinking? Do you see that in soldiers who left the South that went to Europe in the First World War, becoming more aware of the African diaspora in that respect?
I think a lot of people become more aware of the African diaspora. I think they're actually really fascinated by tirailleurs, the Senegalese soldiers that they see fighting with the French army. There's some folks for whom that fascination becomes a bridge, like, oh, I can begin to imagine the ways in which these are my kinsmen, right, that we share something. And then there's some black folks who see those Senegalese soldiers as being so different from them that, no, they don't necessarily kind of begin to embrace, they don't begin to sort of build bridges of solidarity, but they at least are puzzling through the questions of what they think is alike about them and what they think is different. And even understanding that there are other black folks in the world whose experiences might not be like theirs, but are global too, I think does something for a lot of people. So you see the folks for whom this is the beginning of their leaping into a sort of more Pan-Africanist consciousness, and then you see the people for whom this is just opening up a new set of questions about who they are and where they belong. And they might double down on their Americanness having asked those questions, but they're still asking those questions.
I kind of also see the broader effect from the migration. Here in Philadelphia at the museum, we're doing exhibit, and hear me say we, but being a part of that, because I have to, as a tour guide, have to walk people through the effect of the migration on Philadelphia. And one thing that stands out, that Julie Dash did a piece, of artistic installation called Standing at the Scratch Line, where she kind of deals with that expression of people moving, you know, as you mentioned, that large body of people moving to different areas, looking for better life. Is there things that we, and I'm thinking of this here centennial that we're supposed to be celebrating in relationship to World War One, is there things that you would say that we need to be aware of, conscious, and make the connections between then and now when we're talking about this centennial and this celebration that is going on, and how African Americans participated in World War One? How do you suggest to us that we should look at that so that we have a narrative today to, you know, contextualize that?
What do I think? I think that there are things you can do. I mean, this, you talk about migration to Philadelphia, actually getting people to step back and say, how did this city come to be put together this way? Who's here and how did they get here? And have people think about the linkages. You know, too often people talk about kind of the Southern history or the, you know, sort of the urban north or black people in the north without thinking about the fact that many of those black northerners are two generations out of being black southerners, and that a lot of the sort of cultural makeup of of northern black communities is sort of migrant, you know, it's a migrant culture in a lot of ways. So making the history of how Philadelphia comes to look and feel, black Philadelphia comes to look and feel like up south, starting with the war experience is one thing to do. I also think that, you know, the perpetual question, right, when you look at these sort of history after history after history of sort of black military service, betrayal, you know, sort of faith in the government or, you know, Americans broadly recognizing them, and then a betrayal of that faith. It's a history that is not just a World War I history, but in which World War I kind of shines brightly in that story. But sort of pulling back and saying, again, this sort of the question that animated my book, why, what is the relationship between claiming rights, be it in the language of citizenship or some other language, and military service? And what is the story of the nation, broadly speaking, the nation and the state, falling short, not living up to the faith that its populations, marginalized populations of all sorts, but black populations in this particular context, have placed in them, right? And so pulling that story out, so it's not simply about the World War I moment, but it's about the sort of ongoing struggle to give meaning and to make meaning through things like fighting and war, I think, is important. Because I think then you see the links to the dilemmas of now for black veterans, but also for black communities in which lost veterans are visible and prominent, where there's still folks who've given their life over to a nation that will never value that, well, that has not yet valued their life as sort of greatly as it has other people's.
And I appreciate that. One thing that, as you were saying that, a thought came to mind. Isn't this the period or afterwards those soldiers returning that Callie House was trying to get their pension funding because the military wasn't providing black soldiers with the pension they were entitled to?
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay.
Professor Lynn Smith, the incident in Houston in 1917 strangely is familiar to people now. It involved the police at that time. It involved the police abusing a black woman. I think some reports said that they have ravaged her, ripped her clothes off in front of her young children. Talk about that incident in Houston and what the aftermath of that incident. Speak to that issue, please.
So this is Houston. It's, I think, August 1917. The soldiers of the 24th Infantry Regiment, which is a unit of regular Army soldiers, so these are career military. They'd been in the Army, most of them, before the war broke out, are stationed on the edges of Houston to guard a camp. The folks in Houston were very nervous about having what they considered to be sort of Yankee Negro soldiers coming in to their city. And so one of the things that they did was to insist that soldiers, that the provost guard, the MPs that were in charge of these, the military policemen who were in charge of these soldiers, would not be armed when they were moving about the city. There's a day, sort of hot summer day, in which there's some soldiers in Houston, I think in the Fourth Ward, among in black communities in Houston, sort of hanging out. And in the meantime, as you said, a black woman, Sarah Travers, is in her home when a policeman, two policemen, Lee Sparks and Rufus Daniels, come barging in, saying that they're looking for someone who's been, I don't know, shooting dice or something like that. When Sarah Travers asks what right these men have to be in her home, they basically say, "We've had it with you bigoty Negro women. Since these soldiers have come to town, you've been trying to take the town." Drag her out. She's half-dressed because she's been ironing her clothes onto the street. Start dragging her down to take her away to jail. black soldier steps in to ask what's going on. The policemen turn on him, beat him to toss him in the paddy wagon to take him off to jail as well. Another soldier, Corporal Baltimore, mm-hmm. approaches. He's sort of a provost guard. He's in charge of keeping order. Approaches the policeman a little bit later to find out what happened. The policeman beat, you know, so again, now this third person that they beat in the course of the afternoon in public in the Fourth Ward, beat him so badly that rumors come back, go back to Camp Logan saying that he's dead. The soldiers at Camp Logan get stirred up. They're furious. They've also heard rumors that White Houston is going to march on them and attack them, attack the camp. Again, this is just months after the East St. Louis riot, so that is not an unreasonable thing for them to think. And the examples of sort of past violence would suggest that it would have dire consequences. At some point, the soldiers overpower their officers, seize munitions from the tent, supply tent, and themselves march on town, resolving to take revenge on the policemen who've hurt their fellow soldiers. At this point, they know that Baltimore is not killed. He's, in fact, made his way back to camp and joins them on the march on the town.
Now, and some reports say it was up to 156 black soldiers.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
And in formation, right? And, I mean, the thing about it, I think about this scene, and it just seems, again, one of these things that just guts you. Because you have, on the one hand, these guys who are furious. They've taken, you know, as much as they're going to take. They are ready to exact revenge. And again, in this language of manhood, this is how they will stand up for themselves. This is what a man, this is what men do. But then you have other guys, mostly older guys, who've built their entire career on being better than the folks that they have sworn to protect, right? They've built their career by being faithful, talented, amazing soldiers. And they see these other guys, the 150 or so who are marching out, as destroying everything that they've built a lifetime putting together. So they're begging the soldiers not to leave camp. And the soldiers are saying, basically, we have to, we have to. They go out, and in the way that these things happen, you know, they shoot one of the policemen involved, not the worst of them. He's not out that night. But then the other victims include people who are randomly passing by, a Mexican day laborer who's asleep in a boarding house, a kid who stepped out on his front porch trying to see what's happening. And then in the end, the group breaks up. Some folks slink their way or sort of make their way back to camp. The one sort of career officer who'd taken them out, who understood, I think, better than the young guys what they were doing and that there was no turning back from it. So the guy who led in that respect is found the next morning probably dead of suicide, but no one's quite sure. Soldiers are arrested very quickly. Many of them, 13 of them, are rushed through an initial court-martial. And they don't. The folks that they arrest may be the guys who went out, may not be. It's all very, it's done quickly and not well. But in the initial court-martial, they try 13 of them, find them guilty, and execute them before anyone even knows that the court-martial is over, which causes a national outcry among black Americans, and heartbreak among black Americans who take the line that Du Bois basically does, where he refers to them as martyrs, right, the Houston martyrs, and says, we don't condone what they did, but we also completely understand why they did it, and that at, for many of us, there is this sense that at last, right, people are standing up for themselves, right? That usually you hear news reports where so many Negroes die, so many black women killed, black men killed. But in this one instance, it's not a story of their death in that way, right? And again, he says, I don't approve, I do not condone, but I get it.
I think the final total, according to writings of 40 men received life sentences, and 19 were executed.
Some of those life sentences are eventually commuted.
Okay.
This is one of the, not all of them, though, and this is one of the few instances when Wilson is pressured into acting, where he issues an order that says no more, there can be no more military executions without opportunity for review, right? So going forward, it's not supposed to look like what happened in Houston, mm-hmm. but he doesn't go back and change anything that happened to the Houston mutineers either.
Yeah, and none of the white civilians that was involved was ever even brought to any trial.
Right, and actually, Lee Sparks, the guy whose brutality kicked it all off, was back on the force and then in the news for beating somebody else up within, I think, a matter of months.
Professor Lynn Smith, what was the, I don't know whether you ever read any narratives or accounts, what was the black soldiers' feelings of those particular incidents that happened while they were in the service and fighting for the democracy of the United States and seeing this type of stuff going on? Did you ever read any historical narratives or anything from any soldiers?
Well, so if you read Haywood Hall's memoir, and Haywood Hall is someone who joined another black National Guard unit, the 8th Illinois National Guard, and someone who joined it, and he'll tell you, not because he believed in the war as the war, not out of a desire to serve America, but because he wanted to be surrounded basically in a sort of fraternity of cool and fierce dudes, right? So he did it for that sort of, again, he did it for the company. He did it for the sort of compatriot, not patriotism, but compatriotism. But he would, after the war, join the Communist Party and change his name to Harry Haywood, right, and remained in the Communist Party for the rest of his life. And in his memoir, he talks about traveling down to Camp Logan in the wake of the Houston riots and just being furious, how angry they all were that this had happened to their fellow soldiers, that this has happened to their fellow African Americans. And so it's the account he tells of traveling south into Houston is an account of them acting up basically all the way down the railroad line, insulting strangers out the window, messing up stores and whatnot. But he says they carried the bitterness of Houston with them, basically for the duration of their wartime service.
Let's grab a call or two. 602 area code 602. What's your name? Where are you calling from? 602.
Yes, brother. Yes. I'm Marcus here from Memphis, calling.
How are you, sir?
Yes, I'm doing great. And I like the program, this evening, as you know. But you have to remember those two brothers there that exact revenge the other day when them police were shooting black people, Brother Cosmo and Brother Javier. Those were soldiers, too, from the Iraq War, you know. So they exact some revenge for us, you know. So, but I would like to ask the professor, you know, being it's 100 years out now from this war now, you know, it's 100 years out from the World War One. Are there any similarities between then and now? If he sees any similarities between then and now, and if he can explain it a little bit, I will appreciate it, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call, sir.
Bye bye.
I see more similarities between then and now than I would like to. What I always say to my students is we aren't, like, 2017 is not 1917, right? It's a different time and it's a different moment. And yet we live in the world that 1917 made, bequeathed us in some ways. But the, you know, what do I think? I think that we are looking at a presidential administration that is committed to and celebratory of racial discrimination and inequality with a brazenness that stuns me, and that looks far, I mean, looks far more like 1917 than I thought we would see in the 21st century. And that's just the beginning of it, right? I mean, the sort of intensity, I mean, there are transformations. When we think about police violence, when we think about state violence, in some ways, some things look like, say, what kicked off Houston in 1917, but in some ways, they might be even more pernicious because labeling them as racist violence was acceptable in 1917, whereas in 2017, the folks who perpetuate that state violence have found different language for what they're doing, and when it's called out as racist violence, will treat the people who called it out as if they were the transgressors. And that deflection of white supremacist action is far more effective than it should be in a nation of people who ought to be capable of critical thinking.
Yeah, I have to say that, you know, it's interesting as you bring that up, because the growth of what they call white supremacist groups are seem to be growing in this moment, and with Steve Bannon, you know, a aide to the president, kind of seem to have been brought on to actually cultivate and develop that. And the president himself seems to be supporting that, kind of aligns itself to Woodrow Wilson at that point. And then you have the attorney general, Mr. Beauregard, seems to be in line with that kind of that cultural nuance that's a part of the American social and political fiber. So, you know, you kind of seem to see some comparisons in that regard also.
That's exactly right.
Professor Lynn Smith, before we wind things up, I want to jump ahead a little bit and get your feelings on this. I'm going to read from a published report and get you to look at this from an objective point of view. I'm sorry. I had to turn that volume down. To get you to throw some light on this in regards to our people that have been serving in armed forces basically since this country's inception and even till now. And I want to look at it from a systemic point of view, because we've already discussed how that Woodrow Wilson and some of the other politicians during that period openly stated in the halls of an executive branch of government that they wasn't for black soldiers participating in the service and getting the full accolades of being servicemen. But let me read this and get your feelings on it. It's in regards to the GI Bill, which came a lot later. Signed into law by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt on June 22, 1944, this act, known as the GI Bill, provided veterans of the Second World War funds for college education, unemployment insurance, and housing. There are a lot of reasons that whites have so much more wealth than non-whites. How the GI Bill played out is one of these reasons. The law was deliberately designed to accommodate Jim Crow. Of the first 67,000 mortgages issued by the GI Bill, fewer than 100 were taken out by blacks. whites were able to use the government-guaranteed housing that were a pillar of the bill to buy homes in fast-growing suburbs. Those homes subsequently rose greatly in value in the coming decades, creating vast household wealth for whites during the post-war era. Black veterans weren't able to make use of the housing provisions of the GI Bill for the most part. Black banks generally wouldn't make loans for mortgages in black neighborhoods, and African Americans were excluded from suburbs by a combination of deed covenants and informal racism. In short, the GI Bill helped foster a long-term boom in white wealth, but did almost nothing to help blacks build wealth. We're still living the effects of that exclusion today, and will be for a long time to come. Talk about that in relation to the subject we were talking about this evening.
I mean, I think that's exactly right, right? And it's the differential application built into the GI Bill. Right? It's a wonderful idea. But the fact that African Americans were written out of it, and then that their writing out of it was forgotten, so that the sort of black people's inability to build wealth in the same way was then turned around as narrated as their own fault for not doing these kind of post-war, this wise post-war investment and sort of home ownership that other folks were doing, is infuriating, right? Because it's a simultaneous move. It's a structural problem and then a sort of discursive feint to hide the structural move. In some ways, it reminds me, too, that what I meant to say earlier when we were talking about Woodrow Wilson is that I actually, like, Woodrow Wilson said a lot of things. I could care less what Woodrow Wilson said. He was a Southern Democrat from the American South. Of course he was racist. So were most of them. What matters is what Wilson and his administration did.
Yes.
Which was not just to impose the indignity of segregation on African Americans, but to, in segregating Washington on a national level, entrenching segregation in Washington on a national level, they also moved African Americans out of civil service jobs, right? They cut out a key employment base for black Washingtonians and others that also kept folks from continuing to build wealth or to kind of have economic and with it social mobility. That had devastating effects in the long term for African Americans, right? In some ways, that is so much more nasty and pernicious and has lasting effects than him telling darky jokes in the White House or showing Birth of a Nation, right? Mm-hmm. These things that stand as shorthand for the wrongs that his administration did. But one of the things that I always want to say to folks when they're talking about these things is hold people responsible for their actions, never mind their words, right? People can be mean about me. I don't care. I've got plenty of people who are not. But when they dismantle structures of possibility, they are doing devastating work for a community in the long term.
Yes, let's go to 646, area code 646.
Yes, good evening to you, Brother Elliot Richard, and to your guests. My question to your guests is, in your observation from the work that you've done over the years that you have you ever come to the conclusion to what do black people want in this country after all of the struggles that we've been through here?
What do black people want in the country, meaning what do they, like,
what are their hopes and their desires? What are they looking for in regards to the behavior that white people shows towards them? What do they see their position in this country as? Do they really feel as though they are Americans, you know?
Well, so one of the things that I would say is that over my many years of studying African-American history and African-Americans is that black people are varied and variegated and diverse and not uniform. So you ask a dozen people what they want, you're going to get at minimum seven different answers, right? But I think about this question of do they think of themselves as American? What do, if we think of ourselves as a people, like what are the things that you could say run across all of the variations and sort of different orientations that, yeah, they think of, by and large, folks who are here who have chosen to remain here in spite of the sort of difficulty and the hostility. Like, yes, people think of this as home because, you know, what is home but where your family has been or where you've stood? That the willful exclusion from African Americans from narratives of nation or the prerogatives of state, like one of the things that folks have done have been refused to accept that exclusion, right? And to say, you might tell me this is not my home, but I know where my home is. I know that here where my people stand, this is my ground to claim. And in fact, I mean, I think one of the things that carries across too is this sense of entitlement in the face of marginalization and exclusion that says, if anybody built this country, did the hard labor of making American capitalism, of building the structures that people live in or govern in or what have you, it's us, and we might have to continue fighting for God only knows how long to reap the benefits of having built those structures, but we're not giving it up. We're not just turning it over.
Now, do you see that as a sickness?
No. I mean, because I think of it as a stubbornness. But as a stubborn person, I'm not sure that that's so bad. I think a sickness would be to say, please love me, right? In spite of, to people who have only abused you. But I don't think that folks are asking for love. I think they're asking for justice.
You really truly believe that the American Negro is asking for justice instead of love, with all of the oppression that we as a people have faced in this country, the behavior of Europeans towards us, the lack of opportunities truly that's available to us, especially with the way that the country is going in the direction to where these white folks can't take care of their own. I mean, that you know what I mean? That sounds a little, you know, crazy to me. I don't see what is being gained by constantly trying to be accepted by someone that's constantly oppressing you, that's constantly trying to hurt you. I mean, it's just based on my observation on what's going on at this present time with the administration and all of the other things at play. So I mean, that's kind of you know, deep to hear you give that analogy. But you know, I mean, honestly, I think a lot of people, truthfully, that's in your position and who have achieved some of the things that you have achieved as far as educationally, feel that way.
Well, sure, but I mean, but this isn't the point. I mean, I think we're actually kind of saying the same thing, right? But I'm saying that people aren't asking for acceptance. They're asking, they are working to undo messed up structures, recognizing that it was their work that put, that they shouldn't have to give up being here or trying to get access to things just because folks have been working very hard for a long time to stop them from having access to those things. that, yeah, not everybody is going to pack up and leave because they've got family here, they've got history here, they don't know why they should be the ones to have to leave, right? There are folks who think that the only way to get justice is by changing hearts and minds, right, is through acceptance or through love. But there are plenty of folks who could say, no, you can go do your whole thing. You can go over in the corner and hate me all you want to. Just get out of my way, right? That's what the fight is about.
Jay?
I don't know if that's really what the fight is about. I think the fight is more about trying to be accepted by someone who is not a friend, who has no compassion for your survival on the planet, who's basically trying to enslave you in as many ways as possible. And you know, but I understand in a sense on what you're saying, you know, and, you know, I guess that's why, you know, the oppressor gives us the opportunity to obtain certain things in this country. And I enjoy your lecture that you've given this evening, and have a good day. Hotep, Brother Elliot.
Thank you for your call.
You know, one thing I wanted to add that came to mind, Dr. Lex Smith, is the, you know, as we're, you as a historian, do you think the historical perspective of the way African Americans from the World War I is being acknowledged or incorporated in the historical narrative of America? It seems that it's different. It seems that it has a different perspective. Do you see as a historian that there is a unified narrative that brings up what our discussion tonight has been about as it relates to the African-American experience from World War I?
I don't know. Unified. I mean, again, if I just said you take a dozen black people and you'll get at least 7 opinions, you take a dozen historians and you might get 14 opinions, right? But I think it's certainly true that the narrative that we now tell of World War I has to include African-American, not just military service, but an understanding that black freedom struggle is part of the story of World War I, and that World War I is part of the story of the black freedom struggle. And it's not that every historian of World War I is doing that, but I think the folks who do incorporate that into their histories, again, I mentioned Chad Williams, Chris Capozzola, who talks about civil liberties, Eric Yolen, who talks about the Wilson administration's institutionalizing of white supremacy. The folks who are doing it really, really well. And the work that they're doing cannot be discounted or ignored, whether you're talking about popular narratives, you know, the World War I documentary that you saw, or whether you're talking about the work in academic journals.
Thank you for that.
Professor Lynn Smith, I want to thank you for spending some time with us this evening. You have several books out. Before we leave the air, give us the titles of some of the other books and how the people can purchase your work. You know, let me say this before you do that. We have a lot of guests come on from different stratas of life, whether they're historians, college professors, authors, all of them African-American. We need more of our professors on college campuses to do what you're doing. When I say that, I'm talking about spur conscious thought. You spoke earlier about your journey and how you started looking into these things. Because when you started writing your thesis, you discovered some things that you didn't know about. I think that thought and our people being more conscious and awakening their mind is the key to any salvation for our people in this country or anywhere else. Knowledge is key. And I think that on college campuses where a lot of our professors are doing this research might be the linchpin to help our people move forward. I just wanted to mention that before you talk about some of the titles to some of your work.
I agree with you. So I have a book, Freedom Struggles, African Americans in World War I, and I'm writing a book that is not out, but give me a couple of years and look for a book called The Laws Have Hurt Me, African American State Violence and the Legacy of the Civil Rights Movement. I think that's it for now.
Would you say, Richard?
Yeah, I mean, it's when she's talking about those laws that are in place, because they're like, that's a very powerful position. So it'll be interesting to see what your research brings up, because it's the laws are really invisible of how much they affect the social policy, the economic productive machine, and the development of people. And a lot of times we don't pay attention that these laws really, how much do they have impact? I liked the working title that you have and the work that you're working on.
I appreciate your saying so.
Before you leave us, we have one more call on hold. You have time for one more, Professor Lensman? Let's go to 773 area code, 773.
Yeah, you got me, brother?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, but thank you for taking this call, brother. You're having a good show as usual. I heard you talking about the Selective Service, but I don't know if you mentioned this or not, that the Selective Service has a new law that you must register young men 18 to 25. They have a new law. If you do not register, this penalty is severe. $250,000 fine, 5 years in jail or both, no student loan, no government benefits. And a lot of times I printed up flyers. When I see young men, I give it to them. But most young men out here, every one of them I talk to, they have no idea. And I had a grandson who went to put in to be a slave at the post office, and the interviewer, when he went for his interview, that lady asked him when it was over, do you have your Selective Service number? If he didn't have that Selective Service number, he could not even be considered for a job at the post office or any government office. This law passed by a lot of young black men, and they are going to get caught, 18 to 25. Another thing they did with the law, they left it up to the judge's discretion to forgive you if you tell the judge, I didn't know about that. But you know who that law is for, if the judge going to forgive you. That's not going to be for us. Now, I enjoy the professor, but professor, we got to bring this on down home. These people are psychopaths. There are two types of psychopaths, maybe three. But I know one type of psychopath don't know right from wrong. There's another psychopath that know right from wrong, and they decide to do wrong. These people took our humanity when they enslaved us. They never have given it back, never apologized, no reparation, never did nothing. Now, the reason they haven't done that, Professor, because they are not finished with us. They got one last big dance for us, and that is what they're working up to. I know many people don't want to hear that, but right now what we got to do is, we got to try to save as many lives as possible and let people know who are able to escape out of here. Because this is all this crazy police shooting, putting Donald Hitler in office. We know that's a white supremacy country. That boy ain't just popped up and went in office. And Hitler then overthrew the German government. They permitted Hitler to come in. There's a pecking order of power in all these countries. If you're going to change that pecking order of power, you have to overthrow them. Hitler did not overthrow the power in Germany. Donald Hitler did not overthrow the power here. And speaking of this black soldier who came back here and lynched, castrated after fighting for this country, Ida B. Wells went to a Franklin Roosevelt and asked him, hey, what you going to do about these black soldiers coming back here, getting lynched and castrated? And Roosevelt told him, well, tell them don't wear the uniforms on. That's what we get. They don't care how you go and fight for them. German prisoners of war came back here. They had more rights as a prisoner of war than the black soldiers who went over to Europe and fought. Mecca Evers came back here from Europe, wanted to vote, got shot down in the back. The people are not going to change because they are not finished with us. When you're going to exterminate a people, you must dehumanize them. You can't show them no humanity. This is why we are not showing no humanity, not even from the black president. Damn psychopaths go in and assassinate 9 people, say, I'll do it again and I love it. Black president said, no, that ain't terror. No Negro in Congress called it terror. You can't fight no psychopaths like this. This is ridiculous. People, if you can get out of here, get out of here, because these psychopaths, they have extermination on the plate. Now play with it.
Thank you for your call, sir.
Thank you, brother.
Professor Lynn Smith?
Yeah. My spin on that would be to say that much, much, much of human history is dark, and our job is to shine light on it both through knowledge and action. However we, working together, decide is best.
I want to thank you for being with us this evening.
You. I also, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I enjoyed this.
All right. Have a good one.
You too. Bye.
Take care now.
Brother Richard, it was interesting dialogue tonight.
Yes, I think it continues to develop that, the perspective of we're going through time and seeing different waves of the same thing. It's very helpful, hopefully, to the audience and giving them something to follow up on to develop their own consciousness and awareness and views.
You know, let me, I want to read just a few of these before we wind up the program at around 9 this evening. I want to read a few of these, if you indulge me, Richard. A few of these accounts that happened to black veterans that came home from World War I. A month after World War I ended, Private Charles Lewis returned home to Tyler Station, Kentucky, where a mob of masked men lynched him on December 16, 1918. Private Lewis was wearing his uniform when he encountered Deputy Sheriff Al Thomas, who attempted to arrest him for robbery. Private Lewis denied guilt and pointed to his uniform, declaring that he had been honorably discharged and never committed a crime. The two men argued. Private Lewis was charged with assault and resisting arrest. Private Lewis was awaiting transfer to Fulton County Jail in Hickman, Kentucky, as news of his challenge to white authority spread. A mob of 75 to 100 formed. At midnight, masked men stormed the jail, smashed the lock with a sledgehammer, pulled Private Lewis out of his cell, tied a rope around his neck, and hanged him from a tree. The next day, hundreds of white spectators viewed Private Lewis' dead body hanging from a tree in his uniform. Days after Private Lewis' lynching, Louisiana's True Democrat, the newspaper, published an editorial entitled "Nip It in the Bud," summarizing Southern white views on returning black soldiers. This is the quote. "The root of the trouble was that the Negro thought he was being a soldier. He was not subject to civil authority." The paper wrote of Private Lewis, "The incident is pertinent to what may be expected in the future as many more Negro soldiers return to civilian life." The editorial board optioned that military service had probably given these men more exalted ideas of their station in life than really exists. And having these ideas, they may be guilty of many acts of self-assertion, arrogance, and insolence. There will be much friction between them when they sink back into their old groove and accept that social equality will never be accepted in the South. The editorial board warned, this is the right time to show them what will and will not be permitted, and thus save us much trouble in the future. This was a published report in an editorial dealing with the lynching of Private Charles Lewis. On April 5th, 1919, a 24-year-old black veteran named Daniel Mack was walking in Sylvester, Georgia, when he accidentally brushed up against a white man as they passed each other. The white man responded angrily, and an altercation ensued, leading Mack to be arrested. At his arraignment, Mr. Mack said, "I fought for you in France to make the world safe for democracy. I don't think you've treated me right, putting me in jail and keeping me there, because I've got as much right to walk on the sidewalk as anyone else." The judge responded, "This is a white man's country, and you don't want, and you better not forget it." He sentenced Mr. Mack to 30 days on a chain gang. Mr. Mack was serving his sentence when on April 14th, at least four armed men seized him from his cell and carried him to the edge of town, where they beat him with sticks, clubs, and butts of guns, stripped him of his clothes, and left him for dead. On August 3, 1919, a white mob lynched black veteran Clinton Briggs for allegedly insulting a white woman in Lincoln, Arkansas. By moving too slowly out of her way as he tried to walk past him, recently discharged from Camp Pike, Mr. Briggs passed the white couple on the sidewalk and moved only slightly to let the woman pass. She responded angrily, and her companion assaulted Mr. Briggs. A mob gathered and threw Mr. Briggs into a vehicle, drove into the wilderness of Lincoln County, chained him to a tree, and riddled his body with bullets. On March 12, 1919, veteran Bud Johnson had traveled to Florida to bury his father and was awaiting to board a steamboat home to Alabama when he heard barking of bloodhounds. The local county sheriff arrested Mr. Johnson because he allegedly matched the description of a man accused of assaulting a white woman in Pace, Florida. On the way to Jacksonville, a mob overtook the police car, seized Mr. Johnson, and took him to Pace. The mob tortured Mr. Johnson, distributed the $66 they found in his pocket, chained him to a stake, burned him alive, crushed his skull with a hatchet, and gave pieces to the onlookers as souvenirs, and discarded his corpse in a nearby swamp. The mob dispersed. Mr. Johnson's loved ones had to battle alligators to retrieve his remains for burial. On August 31st, 1919, in Bogalusa, Louisiana, when black veteran Lucius McCarty was accused of attempting to assault a white woman, a mob of 15,000 gathered, grabbed him, shot him more than 1,000 times. The mob dragged his body behind a car into the town's African-American neighborhood and then burned his corpse in a bonfire. On December 27, 1919, officers transporting veteran Powell Green to jail in Raleigh, North Carolina, were overpowered by a mob. Mr. Green had been accused of shooting R.M. Brown, the white owner of a movie theater in Franklintown. The mob tied a rope around Mr. Green's neck, dragged him for 2 miles behind an automobile, hung him from a pine tree sapling, as he fought off for the scraps of his, his watch, his chain, chips of the pine tree, all became souvenirs. These public spectacle lynchings were designed to terrorize and intimidate the entire African-American community by torturing, mutilating victims in front of massive crowds. And they succeeded in horrifying and traumatizing generations of African-Americans. Just some accounts of what they did to black veterans when they came home from World War I. It's kind of a culmination of what we've been talking about this evening. I think our people have to understand that fighting in these wars don't get us acceptance from these people. I think that we might have to start taking a page from what A. Philip Randolph, William Monroe Trotter, and Marcus Garvey told our people then about enlisting in these services. I heard Brother X talking about the enlisting of the service, but our people gonna have to take a stand at one time or another. We got to.
You know, that this, you know, in short, this is, you know, the stand, because these laws only come in play because they come in play because we're not, as the political body, who not just advocate, but demonstrate the power. And over again, we hear about the diversity amongst Africans in America. And the question is, we can't keep, like others, we cannot create unity out of diversity when it comes to the point that from a power perspective, what is in our own best interest, even if there is few, and I hear the voices of some say, well, there are a minority that benefit, but we can't create the diversity amongst ourselves. I mean, create the unity amongst ourselves, amongst this diversity, to be able to demonstrate in a society that we, as you just made reference, historically is continuously showing that they don't care what position that you take, when, if it's, they'll use whatever measures in order to regulate or demonstrate what power they exert over us as individuals or as political bodies. But, and it's easier when we are separated amongst ourselves.
Richard, you know, when our people wake up, just like when a person wakes out of sleep, he gets himself together and he determines his next steps. It's time for our people to determine our next steps in a unified fashion. You're going to always have some people that don't want to step with everybody else. We can't worry about them. We got to do what's necessary for our people to move forward, so our children and our women and children can have a positive, productive life, whether it's here or anywhere else. It's time for our people to start making the hard decisions. It's going to come one time or another. I think the time is now. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back next week, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.